This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, August 6, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, the Obama administration announces plans to improve health and safety at immigration detention centers, but rights groups say it doesn't go far enough. The U.S. Postal Service pleads for help after reporting billions in losses. And today is the anniversary of the U.S. dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima.
Suddenly I had bruises all over my body and my skin turned purple. I didn't even know what nuclear meant, and I didn't know about its aftermath.
We talked to Korean survivors of the nuclear bomb. All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with today's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Senate confirmed Sonia Sotomayor to the United States Supreme Court, making her the first Latina and only the third woman ever to join the highest court in the land. The final vote was 68-31, with Democrats unanimously voting to approve. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor will take her seat on the court in early September. Thousands of students battled riot police in Honduras yesterday after the police stormed a peaceful demonstration at the National Autonomous University in Tegucigalpa. Tim Russo has more.
Students at the university were staging a peaceful demonstration, rejecting the presence of conservative presidential candidate Pepe Lobos, when the police began to disperse the crowd with tear gas, rubber bullets, and batons. Confrontations between students and the police continued for the next 3 hours. Several students were injured. Among those caught in the initial repression was University Rector Julieta Castellanos, who until yesterday's repression was known to have supported the recent presidential coup. Castellanos was thrown to the ground by the police as she and the president of the university board of directors, Olvin Rodriguez, waved a white flag while escaping the tear gas in attempts to negotiate with the police. Rodriguez vehemently denounced the police's actions.
We came out with our hands up. We came out in peace, and we were attacked. But we are not going to permit the takeover of university grounds by the police or the army.
Students commented that the police repression may have politicized this otherwise apolitical sector that had been only marginally involved in the recent mobilizations before Wednesday.
Today, for the first time in many years, the students have woken up. We are condemning this fatal coup d'etat.
Also on Wednesday, the president of the Organization of American States announced the creation of a special commission that will travel to Honduras to bring pressure for a diplomatic solution to the month-long Honduran conflict. Tim Russo, FSRN, Tegucigalpa.
Washington's ambassador to the UN says the U.S. is prepared to pay about $200 million it owes for peacekeeping missions and will pay more than $2 billion for what it owes for 2009 as well. Former President George W. Bush's administration had a contentious relationship with the UN and had fallen behind on numerous payments. U.S. Ambassador to the UN Susan Rice told the UN Security Council yesterday that she has received appropriations from Congress to be directed to the UN.
We remain ready to invest in UN peacekeeping. Even in a time of economic crisis.
The U.S. is the largest contributor to UN peacekeeping missions, contributing about a quarter of the program's entire budget. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says it's a great regret that the U.S. is not a member of the International Criminal Court. President George W. Bush decided not to join in 2002, stating concerns that Americans could be targeted in politically motivated prosecutions. Clinton was speaking in Kenya as part of a seven-nation tour in Africa. She was also critical of the Kenyan government's failure to prosecute anyone for violence that followed December 2007 elections, which killed more than 1,500 people and led to a power-sharing agreement in the government. Asked during a press conference if the U.S. might impose sanctions on Kenya, Clinton said it's possible if the authorities can't hold the perpetrators of violence accountable.
But I wanted publicly to say that to members of parliament, trying to resolve this issue internally is far preferable to losing control of it and seeing it go to the International Criminal Court. And, you know, finally, with respect to any actions that our government might take, those are always available and open to us. We hope that that doesn't come to pass.
And Mexico's Supreme Court has ruled to overturn the sentences of 40 men imprisoned for the massacre of 45 people in the southern state of Chiapas. Shannon Young has the story.
The court ruled that federal prosecutors fabricated evidence against at least 40 indigenous men sentenced to lengthy prison terms for their supposed participation in what's known as the Acteal massacre. The men have already served 11 years in prison. On December 22, 1997, right-wing paramilitaries opposed to the area's indigenous Zapatista rebels attacked a church in the village of Acteal during a religious ceremony, killing 45 women, children, and elderly men. The fact that police at a nearby checkpoint failed to intervene on behalf of the villagers has fueled accusations that the massacre was part of an official counterinsurgency strategy. But only one municipal-level official has received any form of punishment. The 40 men declared innocent will remain in prison until after the Supreme Court justices meet on August 12th to officially validate their ruling. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
And those are today's headlines. For Free Speech Radio News in Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
The Obama administration announced that it will undertake a major overhaul of its immigration detention system. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, currently contracts more than 400 private facilities, state and local jails, to hold undocumented immigrants, according to the ACLU. Immigrants' rights advocates have long criticized the conditions inside U.S. detention centers, with Amnesty International charging the U.S. earlier this year with human rights violations. Dania is a former detainee from Honduras. She was held for 4 months at the Hutto Detention Center in Taylor, Texas, where she stayed in a windowless cell with her two children, aged 3 and 9.
Pues mire, cuando yo estuve, la mera verdad, las condiciones eran muy feas, ¿sabes?
The conditions were very tough when I was there. We had to wake up at 5 in the morning, and we had to wake up the children, too. And then we had to go for breakfast, and they would only give us 10 minutes to eat. If we didn't finish, we had to leave the food there. It was difficult for me because I had to feed my little 3-year-old. Sometimes I had no time to eat, and I was also pregnant at the time.
As part of the overhaul announced today, ICE said it would centralize control over detention centers, creating a new office that would review key areas like medical conditions, detainees' access to legal information, and recreational services. Officials also announced they would stop sending families to the T. Don Hutto Residential Facility in Taylor, Texas, one of two detention centers in the U.S. that currently holds children. Immigrants' rights groups welcomed this initiative, but they remain critical of conditions at detention centers. The Texas-based nonprofit Grassroots Leadership has been a strong critic of children's detention. Campaign manager Bob Leibel spoke to FSRN about the conditions at the Hutto Detention Center.
When Hutto opened in 2006, the reports of the conditions from inside were pretty appalling. There was 1 hour of education a day. Children were dressed in prison-like garb. There were reports of guards threatening children with separation as a disciplinary tool. There were prison-like cell counts several times a day. After a lawsuit settlement won by the ACLU and the University of Texas Immigration Law Clinic, the conditions did improve fairly dramatically. There was then a full days of education. Some of the very hard prison-like conditions were rolled back. However, there's only so much that you can do to make a former medium security prison into a facility that is appropriate for children. And so from our perspective, the improvements were good, but they hadn't done nearly enough.
The Obama administration's announcement comes on the heels of another scathing report on the U.S. immigration detention system. The National Center for Immigration Law, or NCIL, released a 180-page report titled A Broken System. NCIL says the U.S. denies detainees access to legal information that would help them prepare their immigration cases, and that in some cases, detainees do not enjoy some basic rights enjoyed by the U.S. prison population, like access to recreational facilities. Much of the information included in the report comes from ICE itself, and through confidential documents obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request. Linton Joaquin co-authored the NCIL's report. He says detention centers are violating the government's own standards.
What we found was that that ICE's own reports indicated many, many violations of their standards that lasted over long periods of time from report to report and were not remedied.
The report also gathered information from visits made to detention centers by independent monitors like the American Bar Association and the United Nations High Commission for Refugees.
The ABA and UNHCR, in many cases, went to the same facility that ICE did and found other violations that ICE failed to identify. And again, you can sit down and track at a detention center the ICE report, the subsequent ABA report, a subsequent ICE report in the next year, and a pattern over time of violations not remedied.
More than 300,000 undocumented immigrants are held at U.S. detention centers every year, and the numbers have steadily risen over the last decade. Joining us now to discuss U.S. detention policy is former FSRN anchor Aura Bogado, who's currently researching immigration issues in Arizona. She's visited several detention centers.
We've got to remember that there are also nightmare stories emerging from adult detention centers. And as you mentioned, I've spent a good deal of time in the last few months in immigration facilities in Arizona, and I've heard extremely unsettling details, including inadequate medical services, less than desirable food with little nutritional value, brown sewage smelling water to take showers in, experiences that really demoralize and demoralize the spirit, and in a word, I think could be described as humiliating.
Would you say the conditions at these detention centers are the same as the conditions in normal prisons, or even worse?
I think that the conditions in normal prisons are governed by a different set of rules. ICE's standards are outlined in what's called the 2008 Performance-Based National Detention Standards, which were they're based on a series of guidelines that were originally authored in 2000. And the current guidelines state the minimum standards for things like recreation, personal hygiene, telephone and other types of communication access, medical care, food services, and everything you can think of in between. On paper, they detail, for example, that every facility would be expected to have a medical department, that they would serve nutritious, attractive meals, that detainees should have access to legal materials in their native language, that inmates won't be retaliated against if, for example, they participate in a hunger strike. ICE is the agency that's responsible for monitoring and ensuring that these standards are followed. ICE is the agency that's charged with oversight on these facilities, even if they are run by private contractors. But what detainees and their advocates say is that these standards are consistently violated. So while they might look fine on paper, ICE's own standards aren't being honored, and they don't really have to be, advocates point out, because there is no legal retribution for not following these standards.
Are you surprised by the announcement by the Obama administration today calling for stricter control over detention centers?
No, not exactly. Let's remember that the standards that I referred to earlier, which ICE is supposedly monitoring, were published in 2008, and they were a revision to standards that were authored in 2000. What we're going to get now is a revision to a revision. But will they be any good? As much as people would like to believe that they might be, the fact of the matter is that these standards are not legally enforceable. If a violation is proven, and so many have already been proven, including under ICE's own admissions, there is no legal recourse. The Obama administration is choosing to create another bureaucratic arm to create what it's calling the Office of Detention Oversight. What it could do is make the more prudent decision to create a set of standards which would allow a judicial consequence if they're not adhered to. Although I'm surprised that HUDO will no longer be detaining children, and that is good news, the bulk of today's announcement screams that this administration is content to follow the Bush-era practice of creating rules that are void of independent legal enforcement.
That was former FSRN anchor Aura Bogado speaking about conditions at immigration detention centers and the recent changes in U.S. immigration policy. The U.S. Postal Service is in crisis, and it's not only because of the economic recession. Email and other technological advances are decreasing the use of sending letters and paying bills through the mail. The post office reported a $2.4 billion loss in the last quarter alone and projects to keep losing money all year. Today, a Senate committee held a hearing on what should be done to help the Postal Service out of the red. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
The Postal Service is expecting a fiscal year loss of more than $7 billion. This comes after making about $6 billion in cost reductions. At Thursday's hearing, Senator John McCain said the White House and Congress have neglected the U.S. Postal Service for too long.
Just as we went from horses and buggies to automobiles, we have gone from hand-delivered mail to the Internet and text messaging and emails and Twitter and all of the other new means of communications. Post office has got to adjust to it, or they will go the way of the horse and buggy and the bridles.
The Postal Service is looking for additional savings by reducing mail service to 5 days a week and closing some post office locations. In the past, Congress has denied the U.S. Postal Service the power to make these changes, but now more lawmakers are saying it should be considered. The U.S. Postal Service says the main reason for its financial troubles is that the government requires it to pay more than $5 billion annually to pre-fund its future retiree health benefits. A bill in the Senate, the Postal Service Retiree Health Funding Reform Act, would restructure the payment schedule. Postmaster General John Potter testified at the hearing Thursday and is in full agreement.
By providing immediate relief from a crushing prepayment schedule for retiree health benefits, enactment of this bill will enhance our liquidity at a time when it's urgently needed. It will reduce our projected losses by over one-third in 2009 and 2010.
The bill would also make the financial stability of the Postal Service a consideration during employee contract negotiations. Again, Potter.
By requiring an arbitrator to consider not just pay comparability, but the Postal Service's financial health as well.
This has postal labor unions opposing the bill. William Burris is president of the American Postal Workers Union.
We have been negotiating contracts since 1970, 39 years now, and we have developed our own relationships, and we don't need a new standard imposed upon us where they put their thumb on the scale and weigh it to require the employees to receive less in their wages and benefits. What they're attempting to do is require the employees to fund their own future retiree health care. They want to do it through negotiations, and we're going to resist that.
Burris says his union won't be supporting the bill because of the arbitration aspect, but he does agree the retirement prepayment obligation is too great.
No other company, industry, or government agency in our country is required to pre-fund future retiree health benefits, and it's unfair to impose that on the United States Postal Service. That is the anchor around our leg today.
Some say the whole system should be looked at altogether. Ruth Goldway is commissioner for the Postal Regulatory Commission.
Whether it is five-day delivery, collection box removal, which has been substantial, or closure of facilities, as the Postal Service proposes, the Postal Service seems intent on reducing its physical presence. No proposals have been put forward to find new sources of revenues at post offices, such as partnering with other public agencies or reinvigorating its brand. These plans bring into question long-held concepts of how the Postal Service fits into the framework of American society.
The Government Accountability Office has put the Postal Service on its high-risk list, a report that lists federal agencies that need serious change. The GAO says the Postal Office needs to restructure because of the role it plays in the economy. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
The U.S. Senate took one last look at climate legislation before the long August recess. They're expected to introduce a bill just after the break. FSRN's Tanya Snyder examines what that bill might look like and what its chances are.
Ever since the climate bill squeaked through the House of Representatives in June, all eyes have been on the Senate. There hasn't been much to see. No bill has been introduced yet, and the healthcare debate has stolen most of the spotlight. But the Senate's Environment and Public Works Committee hasn't forgotten about global warming. Committee member Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island pressed his colleagues to take action.
I don't believe that our present status quo is some ideal state of nature from which any variation is an anomaly or an interference. The status quo right now is riddled with government hand on the levers of our economy. It just happens to put those hands in places that benefit dirty, polluting industries.
But Republicans are pushing back. John Barrasso of Wyoming criticized the Democrats for moving too quickly.
Now some in the majority in Congress want to move at breakneck speed to pass a 1,500-page cap-and-trade scheme. With the failure of an economic stimulus package to create the promised jobs, should America believe that the 1,500-page cap-and-tax bill will work?
Some opponents call the bill cap and tax because it would tax carbon emissions from industry. They say energy companies will simply pass the costs down to consumers. The Congressional Budget Office says the average household will end up paying $175 more per year by 2020. The Conservative Heritage Foundation estimates the cost to be more than 10 times that amount. A new study from McKinsey & Company, a global research group, says energy efficiency measures will cost $500 billion up front, but result in savings of more than $1 trillion down the road. Dave Hamilton directs the Global Warming and Energy Programs at the Sierra Club.
The more energy efficiency you do, the more downward pressure on energy demand you create, and the more downward pressure on energy demand there is, the lower the price goes.
Senator Barbara Boxer, who heads up the Environment and Public Works Committee, has indicated that she'd like to tweak the House bill. There's speculation she wants a higher goal for reducing carbon emissions, and that she might take issue with the decision in the House to give away most of the initial pollution credits rather than sell them. John Kerry, Boxer's closest co-conspirator in crafting a bill, wants tougher controls on speculation in the financial markets on trading of pollution credits. But the Democrats are going to need 60 votes to get the bill through. Though there can be no accurate vote count for a bill that doesn't exist yet, energy industry observers like Energy and Environment Daily and the Van Ness Feldman Law Firm predict there are about 50 solid votes for a climate bill. That leaves a lot of room for negotiating with senators like Republican George Voinovich, who worries that current technology isn't up to the demands of the new bill.
If all these provisions don't work out as planned, and government programs rarely work out as planned, the cost could be enormous.
So Boxer and Kerry's desires to strengthen the bill may fall by the wayside in exchange for compromises with fence sitters. And where all the negotiations on the House bill went on in the Energy and Commerce Committee, no less than 6 Senate committees have their hands on this one. Senate leadership will have the final say on what goes in the bill, though whatever Boxer's Environment Committee introduces in September will be a strong influence on the final Senate version. Hamilton says that could make a big difference.
You know, you've got at least one committee that is of pretty committed environmentalists, or at least a majority is pretty committed environmentalists that want to see, not only a bill to reduce carbon emissions, but a bill that with structure and function that is going to work.
Senate leaders say they hope the bill will come up for a final vote on the Senate floor in October. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
64 years ago, the U.S. Air Force dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. A few days later, another was used to attack Nagasaki. Hundreds of thousands of people died as a result of the explosions, but not all were Japanese. Many were Koreans, conscripted to work in factories in those cities. Some of the surviving victims gathered today in Seoul. FSRN's Jason Strother tells us their story.
The audience at this remembrance ceremony rises to its feet as the South Korean national anthem is played. But 6 decades ago, many of the people here were forced to pledge their allegiance to Imperial Japan. At the time, Korea was a Japanese colony, and as the Second World War came to an end, an estimated 70,000 Koreans were living in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 74-year-old Byun Yeon-ok was a 10-year-old elementary school student in Hiroshima. She vividly remembers what happened on the morning of August 6th.
어느 날 학교를 갔는데 학교 마당에서 하늘이 반짝하고
The bomb dropped when I was at school playing with my friends in the playground.
사진 찍으러 많이 왔어요. 그 비라를 만드느라고
Suddenly, I saw a yellow flash in the sky, and I thought somebody was taking a picture of us. But there was a huge storm after that, and I hid under a tree. I thought it was the end of the world.
밑에 학교 나무 밑에로 뛰어들어가서 이렇게 했는데 그 순간에 그냥
Another A-bomb was dropped on Nagasaki on August 9th, causing equal devastation.
40,000 Koreans lost their lives during those attacks, but the long-term side effects of radiation poisoning would affect many more, including Byun and many of the 27,000 other survivors.
그랬는데 한국에 이제 나오려고 하니까 연락선이 끊어진 거예요.
My family and I decided to go back to Korea in October because we thought we didn't get hurt from the bombing. So we took a smuggling vessel back to Korea, and it took over a week to travel because we couldn't move at night. There were still hundreds of torpedoes in the sea. However, I felt something weird about my body after my family arrived in Busan. I didn't even know what nuclear meant, and I didn't know about its aftermath. Suddenly, I had bruises all over my body, and my skin turned purple.
For decades, the Korean A-bomb survivors had almost no medical support. Kim Young-gil, a Hiroshima survivor and representative of an A-bomb victims advocacy group in Seoul, explains why. Kim says in 1974, the Japanese government issued a directive to not give any medical or financial assistance to victims living in other countries. But after a lawsuit in 2003, Tokyo was forced to provide some compensation. Now Japan gives Korean survivors around $400 each month. But with the help of the advocacy group, some are suing for the 30 years of missing benefits. Jeff Kingston, who lectures in Asian studies at Temple University in Tokyo, says based on previous court cases between A-bomb survivors, known as hibakusha in Japanese, and the Tokyo government, the Koreans are likely to win.
Well, I think they have a good legal basis because the Supreme Court decision, you know, basically found the 74 ministry instruction illegal. So it would mean then that that instruction, having been declared by the Supreme Court as illegal, should have no standing, meaning that the ministry actually deprived these hibakusha of their just benefits.
But some are concerned that the money will come too late. Kim Young-gil of the Korean A-bomb victims group says the average age of survivors is now 75. Kim says in another 10 to 20 years, they will all be gone. His organization has started an anti-nuclear weapons and peace campaign because they say it's more effective when actual victims of a nuclear weapon call for the end of nuclear weapons around the world. But Kim also wants the United States to show more responsibility for the use of nuclear weapons. The 1951 San Francisco Peace Treaty that ended the Second World War did not require the U.S. to give any compensation to the survivors. Kim says even a small gesture to the Korean survivors would be better than nothing. We are hoping to build a peace park like the one in Hiroshima here in Korea, Kim says. He hopes that the United States will at least give some money to help them build this. Kim and other A-bomb survivors plan to make their case known at a conference aimed at reducing nuclear arms to be held next year in New York. Jason Strother, FSRN, Seoul.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliates, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Benad K. Jones and Catherine Comp. Our headlines editor was Andrew Stelzer, and the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.